Second announcement is that the movies, the films, I have done what I think is the way to do it, and they will be available. I think the first one is available now, and you can watch it in the privacy of your rooms in whatever college you are. You are to please see them. Paths of Glory goes with next week, and that's the first one. And it's very short, it's very good. It's one of the first Kubrick films, and it's about the mutinies. And I will talk about the mutinies next week. So please have seen the film by Monday. Can you tell them in section how they do that? I mean, I did it, but I'm not sure how I did it. So they should be set up. But it's a film. Another thing you can do is you can go down to film studies in the Whitney Manning Center, and you can check out the film and watch it there. Or I think you can take it back also. But you can watch it on your computer screens. So, those are the three. The first one is the first one, and then the second one is the second one. Boy, I'm really awake today. The second one is Triumph of the Will, which will go with the fascism lecture. And be sure to have seen it before. And the last one is Au revoir les enfants, Louis Malle film, which will be subtitled in English, and I think, yeah. And yeah, it is. And that goes with the second to the last lecture. So make sure you see these films. And none of them are long, and they're all great, great, great films. So if you can buy into Kirk Douglas as a French soldier, you have to suspend reality a little bit to do that. Okay. Any announcements? Things happening? All right. So today, this lecture. Much of it just parallels the chapter, because the origins of World War I can be confusing, and I just want to make those perfectly clear so that you know the stuff. So help you read the chapter. And also, we used to have you read Goodbye to All That, which is very long but very good, Robert Graves, and then we used the inevitable All Quiet on the Western Front, but we suppressed those, and so it's even more important that you read the chapter. So let me get into that, and I'm not going to write all the terms on the board because there's so many, and I sent them around, so it's just it's hard to see anyway. So what I have up here is when I talk about birth rates is between the drilling, God darn it, in the background. Anyway, live births 1908, 13 per 1,000, but I'll go into that in a minute. So let me, start now. So, because World War I, 1914, so many people wanted war, and they ran to the Gare de l'Est and chanted up à Berlin, and drank lots of champagne, and then in Hauptbahnhof in Berlin, they chanted nach Paris. Nobody knew that the war was going to last over 4 years and kill millions of people and mark the end of four empires and arguably help contribute to the end of the fifth, that is the British Empire, the impetus toward decolonization that comes out of World War I. Nobody knew that the war that was supposed to be over by December wasn't going to be over by December. And outside of a couple of journalists who had been following the Russo-Japanese War in Manchuria, had seen kind of the evolution of trenches, nobody predicted that kind of war. And I'll talk about military strategy at the end today, or in the plans for the war, or depending on time, the timing, the end of or the beginning of next hour. But so this makes the origins of the war so much more important. And there's certainly, in terms of diplomatic history, there's no other event in the history of the world that has been so pored over than the diplomatic origins of World War I. The famous entangling alliances, the house of cards that collapses, all of those very familiar images. And after the war, I had this great uncle who fought in the war. I mean, great, great uncle. I mean, he was an old dude when I was a very little guy. And he'd been in France in 1917, and at the end of the war, I remember when I was a little kid, he gave me the sort of printed out books showing that the Germans had started the war. I mean, it was the official account of the origins of World War I. And of course, the fact that at the end of the war ends with German troops inside France, This has a huge, huge impact on what happens because of two things looking ahead. One, it became very easy for the German right to say, we weren't defeated. We were stabbed in the back. By who? By the Jews, by the communists, by the socialists. And secondly, because Germany was defeated, they had to sign on the bottom line saying, we started the war alone, we alone, the famous war guilt clause. War guilt clause. Now, the Germans didn't start the war alone, and I'll leave it to you to decide whether their responsibility, the famous blank check given to Austria-Hungary, is more important than the roles of other states. Russia declaring mobilization, which was tantamount to an act of war for reasons we'll come to, or France for that matter. But that's why the origins of World War I are so important. And the other reason is that clearly, World War I unleashes the demons of the 20th century. That the kind of racist stuff, the even somewhat genocidal stuff is out there in the public domain. But World War I turns it loose. And we talk about, I hope convincingly, the Europe of Extremes, which is a title of a wonderful book by Eric Hobsbawm, and one extreme being communism. But the other extreme, which was more prenant, which was more victorious, more overwhelming in Europe, was the rise of fascism. And in particular, the rise of National Socialism. And this stuff was out there, but National Socialism and the Nazis cannot be understood without World War I. So that's why this stuff on the origins, this diplomatic history, is so important. So that's why I'm paralleling what you are reading. Now, that people, if you ask people in the 1880s and 1890s, who will fight in the next war? Many people in Germany, most people in Germany, and many people in France would say that it'll be the Germans fighting the French because of Alsace-Lorraine. Other people, as we'll see, particularly in the 1890s, will say, no, it's the British and the French who are going to be fighting. Colonial rivalries, fashoda, and all that business. But the one, you know, as I and what you're reading, as I put it, the old hatred that is cannot be put off stage. During the entire period, even when French and British relations are at their nadir, at their worst, is that between Germany, united, the empire proclaimed in the Hall of Mirrors at Versailles, Chateau de Versailles, and France, because after all, the French had to give the second most industrialized region, one of the most prosperous regions, that is Alsace and much of Lorraine, to Germany. And I'm going to end up with an incident that looked like war was possibly going to break out between Germany and France, and that is the Zabern or Zavern incident, and talk a little bit about Alsace-Lorraine and stuff that isn't in the book later, just to make it clear. And it is complicated, because the French could never accept the fact that Alsace and much of Lorraine was now German. Now this is, again, remember we talked about nationalism and constructed identity. Most people in Alsace and in those parts of Lorraine that became part of the Second Reich, the Second Empire, what do they speak? They spoke German dialect. They did not speak French. More about that later. There was bilingualism, but that's interesting. If you ask them, you know, what nationality are you, and they reply in German, I am French. You know, if you were somebody doing a survey now, you'd be sort of shocked by that. But, I mean, these are complex, these identities. So anyway, the rivalry between France and Germany was already always there. If you went to the Place de la Concorde in Paris, the statue of Strasbourg, the town of Strasbourg, which important European capital now, but of the new Europe, for better or for worse, was covered in mourning cloth for much of the period, because it had been amputated. They used this image often, that the right arm of France had been amputated in the settlement after the Franco-German War. So that rivalry is there. And French military planners, right through the whole period, at the time of Boulanger, who was one who built his reputation, you already have read about the general, Georges Boulanger, You know, he is Mr. Revenge. And a military planner said, when the war comes, we will move into Alsace and take Alsace and parts of Lorraine back, and then we will move to Berlin. Simple, just like that. And to the very end, that's their military strategy. Attack. They're going to attack and get back Alsace-Lorraine. What the Germans plan to do has a lot to do with the way the war starts, and we will get there. Now, the second big rivalry in Europe, and again, think of the 28th of June, 1914, Sarajevo, 16-year-old heavily armed Gabriel Princip, is that between Russia and Austria-Hungary. And their rivalry is over the South Slavs, who are within the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and the Serbs, who are not, but who provide a constant force for destabilization in the region. Now, as you know, since the time of Catherine the Great, she set her eyes on Istanbul, Constantinople, the same city, on the Straits, on access to the Black Sea, that there was always going to be this drive of Russia to the Straits. And as you know, later, I mean, Turkey allies with Germany. But the big rivalry is in terms of Russian influence, destabilizing influence, seeing itself as the protector, the mother of all of the Slav peoples, is a permanent force of destabilization in the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Ironically, the guy who gets offed, along with his wife, the Archduke Francis Ferdinand and his wife, he was one of the he was a prejudiced figure in many ways, but he was considered a moderate because he somehow he believed that the South Slavs should have kind of a third status along with, along with Germany and, Austria and Hungary within sort of a tripartite empire. And of course, he gets gunned down, and what comes next is the blank check, where the Germans say, do what you want to settle this situation, and the famous ultimatum to Serbia by Austria-Hungary. And the Russian government stirs up pan-Slavic fervor in the Balkans. They work consistently to do that. You know, there are religious ties, the Orthodox religion, there are ties of alphabet, the Cyrillic alphabet used in Serbia. Serbo-Croatian is the same language, but spoken language, so Serb friends and Croatian friends would deny that in some ways, but basically it's the same spoken language. But the Serbs use Cyrillic alphabet, which is what the Russians use, and the Croats, who are Catholic, use you know the alphabet used in Western Europe. So the European alliance system, this entangling alliances, hinges on French and German enmity and the competing interests of Russia and Austria-Hungary in the Balkans. And it also hinges on Bismarck, who is in many ways an odious guy, but very, very clever guy. His fear that Germany would have to fight a war on two fronts. And so what these powers are doing are looking for allies. And as Bismarck said, it's interesting, he said it in French, showing that in many ways French was still the language of diplomacy. He said, when you've got these great powers, five of them, in quotes, you have to be à trois. You have to be with the three and not the two. And his worst nightmare, and Bismarck was somebody who he said he liked to lie awake at night and hate. His worst fear was having to fight the Russians and having to fight the French at the same time. And so when he encourages the French to get into the imperial game at the beginning, he's doing that to try to, you know, get them to blow off a little steam out there in Africa. My map of Africa is here. Remember the line about the map of Europe. And so he said, here's the exact quote, all international politics reduces itself to this formula, try to be à trois, as long as the world is governed by the unstable equilibrium of five great powers, Germany, Austria-Hungary, Russia, Britain, and France. And these treaties, these arrangements, that is the emergence of the Triple Alliance and the emergence of the Triple Entente, the time of the war, these are Italy is up for grabs, open to the highest bidder, and Italy would go to war despite having been a member original of the alliance with Austria-Hungary and Germany. It will go to war on the Allied side because the Allies promised them more in 1915. But that's another story, but that's very important in the emergence of fascism in Italy, because Italy after the war, though nominally victorious, does not get what it wants. It does not get the Dalmatian coast. It does not get the Tyrol mountains, because if you fought a war based on national claims, why turn around and give regions and have only a minority of Italian populations to Italy? And Benito Mussolini goes from being a socialist to being a fascist, helps create that party based upon this idea that Italy had been screwed. They never got what they were supposed to in World War I. And so he comes to power as a fascist, in 1922. So in 1879, Bismarck forges this cornerstone alliance between Germany and Austria-Hungary, and it's predicated on German support for Habsburg opposition to the expansion of Russian interests in the Balkans. And you can see in this the origins of the famous blank check in the summer, hot summer as it was, in 1914. And in 1880, Italy allies with Germany and Austria-Hungary, forming the Triple Alliance. But the wording is such that it doesn't necessarily bring Italy into the war. And as I said, Italy will come in on the side of Austria-Germany, Austria-Hungary and Germany, and Italy comes in, as I just said, in 1915. Now, the details of these treaties, and these diplomats are still under the influence of Metternich and all that. Now, the details are not known, but the outlines are known. I mean, the details are not known, but the outlines of these treaties are basically basically known. And one theme right through the period is every time that Russia seeks to expand its influence in the Balkans, Austria-Hungary gets concerned, and they turn to Germany saying, you will back us, won't you? And they say, yes, of course, we will back you. And in the end, what happens is that the blank check goes to, after the ultimatum, to Serbia by Austria-Hungary, do whatever you want to settle the situation. We will back you all the way. Now, why does Germany become encircled diplomatically and ultimately in war? How does it happen that Russia, czarist autocratic Russia, allies with republican France, that the czar, the oppressor of the non-Russian peoples, especially the Jews, in Russia, comes to Paris in 1889, and they name a beautiful bridge after him, the Pont Alexandre III, the bridge of Alexander III. And that the Marine Band learns the theme song of the czars, and the socialists go wild in France. How can you ally with these people who are repressing socialists, who are repressing nationalities, they're repressing everybody, and run this police state? And so the last thing that Bismarck wanted are these two big states to come together on either side of them. How does this happen? Both France and Russia are outside of the Triple Alliance, which you already know. But there's another reason. As a matter of fact, I read about 4 or 5 years ago, there are still French companies trying to get their money back from Russia because they lost their money in 1917 when the Bolsheviks came to power and ultimately nationalized industries, big industries particularly. It is economic, in that one of the old things that people say about the French economy, but is still true, is that French money, investments, much of it goes outside of France. They build the railroads in Spain, but they invest heavily in Russian industry and in Russian railroads. And so these economic ties are very important. I mean, there are also cultural ties. I mean, because of the, you know, because of the popularity of French in aristocratic circles within in Russia. But on the other hand, there were lots of Russian nobles who spoke German, you know, who lived in Königsberg, which is still, you know, the sort of enclave now that is still part of Russia, sort of stuck between, you know, Poland and Lithuania. But the most important reason is that Russian French investment in Russia increases dramatically in the 1880s and 1890s. And that, you know, France seeks an ally against Germany, and that relations between Russia and Germany, and this is already obvious, you've already discerned this, are going to deteriorate because of this tender relationship between Austria-Hungary and Germany over the Balkans. And in the very end, I mean, one of the ludicrous aspects of this whole damn thing is that just as they're about to go to war, and just as Tsar Nicholas II, about whom we'll come back and discuss one day, he signs the mobilization order. And mobilization, for reasons I'll come back to, is tantamount to an act of war. He's dashing off letters to his dearest cousin, Willie. And Willie is writing back to my dear cousin, Nicky. These people are related, they're cousins. But international circumstances and the tensions over the Balkans and French fears of Germany bring Russia and France together, and the French Marine Band sings or plays whatever the theme song of the Russian Tsars is. It certainly wasn't Dr. Zhivago, but whatever, when they arrive. And so for the Russian government, it blames Austria-Hungary for trying to undercut what they view as their logical influence in the Balkans. And Germany will back them right away. So in 1892, France and Russia sign a military treaty that says that there'll be a military response if the other were attacked by Germany or by one or more of its allies. And they form a formal alliance in 1894. Now, what about Britain? What about Britain? Now, one of the things that the British don't want to ally with anybody. And they're on bad terms with the French, and they're on bad terms with the Russians. To make a long story short, the Great Game, as they called it, rivalry over Afghanistan, over the entire, you know, sort of extension of that frontier into Asia, means that the chances of Great Britain joining an alliance with Russia and with France seems extremely dim. Britain wants to control the seas and to go it alone. But they discover a fact that shouldn't have surprised them in the Boer War in South Africa, is they don't have any friends. That nobody supports what they're doing in South Africa. And it's better to have an ally in a world that gets increasingly dangerous. And what happens gradually is that the rivalry between Germany, again, to make a long story short, between Germany and Britain ultimately will cause Britain to look for allies, and that suddenly it seems less probable that France and Britain will go to war. Now, what is the nature of this increasingly bitter rivalry between Germany and Britain? One is obvious: Africa. That's one. Second, economic. In that the German economy is growing by leaps and bounds. It is the number one country in chemistry. The university system, where in Britain, the university system isn't terribly practical. But in Germany, chemistry is part of what they do in the German universities, which are great universities. And they begin to lap the British in chemistry, chemical productions, and they catch up and go ahead and steal too. And so this is a big rivalry. And the British government begins to run scared because the city is running scared. And third is this famous naval rivalry, that which Paul Kennedy, my colleague and friend, has written a book, The Anglo-German Naval Rivalry, is that the Germans start turning out these huge ships. And then the British respond. They produce the dreadnought, which becomes a symbol for these huge, powerful battleships, as such nothing had ever been seen before. And the naval leagues in both countries, again, this is the culture of imperialism, the culture of aggressive nationalism, put huge pressure on governments to throw every available resource in the building of more and more ships. And Britain, which has always basically controlled the seas since the Armada, and the late the defeat of the Spanish Armada in the late 16th century, they're running scared. Now again, you know, you can't look ahead and say, aha, but there was only one naval battle of any consequence in World War I, at the Battle of Jutland off the coast of Denmark, and it's kind of a draw, but basically the Germans are forced back into port, so they lose. But nobody, the British, could anticipate that. So their fear of Germany and the saber rattling of the thoroughly irresponsible idiot Wilhelm II helps make it possible to imagine an alliance with the sneaky French. Now, in the 1890s, there were a lot of war novels about future wars. And this in itself reflects the fact that many people thought there would be another war. Again, they didn't know it's going to be a war of 4.5 years, but they think there's going to be another war. And one, I assure you, I've never read the following book, but one of the more successful was, for a brief time, was this sort of book about a future war. And it's in the, I guess it's in the early 1890s, or about the time of Fashoda, maybe, but it's in the 1890s, or maybe the first couple years of the 20th century, it doesn't matter. Dover. The middle class of Dover are out parading in the rain, around in the rain on a Sunday morning. Miserable weather. And they suddenly find that Dover's been taken over by the sneaky French. That they've been digging a tunnel under the English Channel. Now, Napoleon wanted to dig a tunnel under the channel. There is a tunnel under the English Channel. The tunnel, the trains rocket along, at least until they got to Britain, and then it kind of plod along at about 2 kilometers an hour, but then they've improved that side of it anyway. There's sort of a French bias, but too bad. So they suddenly find that, as they're strolling along in the pouring rain, horizontal rain, that these sneaky French, that there are soldiers all over. And taking these sort of national stereotypes, that the French are disguised as waiters, wearing dirty waiter uniforms. And under their, this is the British image, I wouldn't even comment on what English kitchens would have been like or something, but it'd be a cheap shot. But under these towels wear sneaky weapons. And they take over Dover. And then, of course, the British get it together, and they drive them back into the tunnel and shoot a few, and then they cement up the tunnel, and then Parliament passes lots of more battleship bills, et cetera, et cetera. The future novel. But there's another one 4 or 5 years later, and I haven't read this one either, and I ain't going to read it. And the people in Whitby, speaking of, or Scarborough, speaking of horizontal rain, in the East Coast, they wake up and they see these huge German battleships just lobbing shells that can reach and blow up York, lobbing one shell after another. And the sequel isn't very interesting, but the British Parliament passes even more bills, and then the battleships of the good guys, in quotes, go and blow up the battleships of the bad guys, and everybody can go back to eating odd things on a Sunday morning. So how does it happen that scenario is reversed of what the future will be? Well, I've just explained it. It has to do with the fears of both of these states of Germany. And that the crises, which you can read about, the Moroccan crises in 1905, makes even firmer this military alliance. It's called an entente, or which is a word in English too, or an understanding, but basically it's an alliance. And by 1905, they're already saying, look, our Navy, the British Navy, will take care of the North Sea and the Channel, and you guys take care of the Mediterranean. The crisis in 1911, the second Moroccan crisis, which pushes Germany and France close to war, affirms all of the above things that I've said. Now, don't get the idea that in 1911 things are more dangerous than 1910, and 1910 they're more dangerous than 1909. Again, this sort of hydraulic model of everything pressure building up and finally there is war. It doesn't work like that. But that these alliances become firmed up, and of these great powers that Britain and France and Russia end up in, Bismarck was dead by then, but in his worst nightmare of being à trois, of being three. Now, the French, by the way, had another reason to be particularly eager to have an alliance, is that an odd thing happens in La Belle France, in most of France. The French population stops growing. It just stops as of 1846-47. It's regionally specific in Brittany and in the Auvergne, in the center of France. People are still churning out babies. You still have huge families. We have friends, one of them just died, older people, and they grew up in misery in the mountains. Misery. They had 13 children and 12 children. They were one of 12 or 13 children. But in most of France, that's not the case. And in one part of southwestern France, when people had a second baby, they received a condolence card. Isn't that bizarre? The French population stops growing. Why? There are a couple reasons. This is just an aside, but it's interesting. The Napoleonic Code, remember, ends primogeniture, so you've got to divide up the plot of land into two or three, or into two. Birth control. There's two arguments, is that the peasants start it, and then it filters up to the middle classes, or the middle class starts and filters down. It depends on where you are in France. But they stop having children. Look at this. I wrote it on the board, but it may be in the book, I don't even remember. But here's live births, 1908, 1913. Per 1,000. Italy, 32.4. Austria, 31.9. Germany, 29.3. England, 24.9. USA, 24.3. France, 19.5. I mean, that is so low. The French population would have literally not grown had it not been for immigrants. Immigrants then were people coming from Italy and from Switzerland, but mostly from Italy, and from Spain too, some, and from Belgium. So, what's the effect of this? Is that there's this enormous crisis. It has to do also with this sort of threatened virility. Why do we have fewer children? What's the matter with us? France is becoming too effeminate, et cetera, et cetera. You can just hear the language of this. Women are not serving the state. Why are they not having babies anymore? What's the matter? They want to vote? Is this getting in the way with having babies that could be sent off to war? So it causes an enormous problem. And it's discussed all over the place, particularly by the nationalists. We don't have enough children. Jumping ahead, and I'll come back to this. Verdun, 1916. The Germans say, we're not going to take the forts at Verdun. They're impenetrable, untakeable, cannot be taken, they cannot be pris. But we will make them pay so many hundreds of thousands of people that we will bleed them, and they'll be forced to sue for peace. Falkenhayn was the general. We won't take the forts, Douaumont and Vaux, but we will kill so many hundreds of thousands of people, and we can afford to lose hundreds of thousands of people because our birth rate is higher. Nice for the people sent into all this stuff. More about that later. So this has a big effect. You know, if you're going to go to war and get Alsace-Lorraine back, and as Germany gets more and more aggressive, irresponsible, no question about it, in an age of aggressive nationalism, You better have somebody else to help you out. Because there's a lot of them, and they blew us away in 1870, 71. And they defeated, they didn't blow away, but they defeated Austria. Prussia defeated Austria in 1866, cementing its role as the most important power in Europe. So that helps as well. Now, the French fears and all that. Now, a couple more points. I want to give you an example from this, and I mentioned it just briefly, but it's interesting about how this works, how small incidents in a complicated world of national rivalries and competing identities can almost launch the war. It took the assassination of Francis Ferdinand to start it all off. There would have been a war sometime. And this is the case of Zabern in German, Zavern in French, S-A-V-E-R-N-E, a very nice little town. Went to Zavern, got to see all these places. I went to Zavern, there's a nice canal runs through it. Now, Alsace and Strasbourg were annexed to France in 1681 by the megalomaniac Louis XIV. So they had been part of France a very long time. And in 1871, for reasons you know, they become part of Germany. But this incident at Zavern, what it does is it reinforces the stereotypes that the French have of the Germans and that the Germans have of the French. The image of German quest for domination and aggressiveness and the role of the German army, which seems to have absolutely no limits. As someone once said about Prussia, that it was a state tacked on to an army. And the Zavern affair seemed to indicate that Germany was still the same way. Now, if you go up to Alsace, you go up to the Vosges Mountains, there's this route called the Route des Crêtes, or the route of the peaks. And you can look down into the Vosges, which was France, you know, until 19, it still is France, but from what had been German Alsace, and you can see all of these monuments put up by German hiking clubs to try to reaffirm this German identity that people had. And identity is extremely, extremely complex thing. But first of all, what is clear is that the vast majority of the population spoke German. Now, whether this makes them feel German or not, it's not sure. But let me give you a couple examples. I didn't send this around; it's too much. But let's say that for the total of Alsace and Lorraine, the parts that were annexed into the German Reich, that the number of communes that in which German was the dominant German dialect was the dominant language is 1,225. In which French was the dominant language was 385. And the percentage of the population that spoke German is 77%. The population that spoke French as their major language, 12%. There was some bilingualism, but not a whole lot, actually. And 10% sort of neither, in that they were probably more or less perfectly bilingual because of intermarriage. And so, you know, when the Germans come in, after 1871, they are better than what the French did after World War I. The French tried to just rip German out as a language of instruction, get rid of all the street signs in German. The Germans are a little more delicate in the way that they do things, but they want German is the language of the administration. But another important point is that they don't trust the Alsatians. Even though they speak German, they don't trust them. That Alsace and those parts of Lorraine are not, they're annexed into the Reich, but they don't have the same rights as a region that the other parts of Germany, like Württemberg and Bavaria, have. And that German deputies from Alsace and those parts of Lorraine don't have the right to vote on issues of war, for example, in the Reichstag. They are not trusted because they are seen as potentially disloyal to the Reich. The idea is that they have been infected with Frenchness. Now, part of this is religious in that, you know, it's so complex. Alsace is a wonderfully interesting area. It has the largest percentage of Protestants in France outside of Ardèche in the south center. It's also got a large percentage of Jews who had been victimized by anti-Semitic riots after 1848. But the majority of the population is Catholic. The German Empire, going back to the Kulturkampf of Bismarck, the war against the Catholics, still doesn't really trust the Catholics. You've got Catholics in Bavaria, usually very right-wing Catholics in Bavaria. You've got Catholics in the Rhineland. You've got some Catholics up north in the Palatinate. And you've got a lot of Catholics in Alsace. And so they don't trust them, basically. They don't trust them. And so relations between the German troops, who, as in the case of Spain, are not coming from that region. Spanish people who occupy in Catalonia come from Galicia, or they come from Castile. So they won't be infected by the local population from the point of view of the Spanish state. And so the troops that are in Alsace are not from Alsace, because they don't trust them. And so tensions are very good. And so what happens in Zaverne, at a place where military-civil relations aren't terribly good, in this town of 8,000 people, there is an incident that gets blown out of proportion. There's some drilling. They're drilling. The German soldiers are always drilling. And they're drilling, and the commander makes a crack about the Alsatians, and he calls them an extremely unfortunate scatological term that he meant to refer to all Alsatians. And he essentially says, well, if you beat the hell out of those people, you'll be doing a service to all. So this gets around. And one of the reasons that relations weren't very good in this particular town is because there was a German officer who was had the bad idea of sleeping with a 14-year-old girl. And so some of the local guys go get this guy in his room and just pound him into a well-deserved pulp. And so it spins out of control. And so what happens is on both sides, in Berlin and Paris, this becomes a huge incident, confirming the stereotype of the other. And there's nasty language. Bethmann Hollweg, who is the chancellor then, you know, says some over-the-top things about the French and the influence of France in Alsace, et cetera, and that the French are planning a war, and the French government in a time when there is a nationalist revival, at least among the elites in France, they respond in kind, and everything gets big titles, big titres, big headlines and stuff like that, and they don't go to war. But what it does is it reaffirms these stereotypes, and it makes people a little more edgy. Now, in 1913, but well before that, military planners, yes, I have 3 minutes, and that's just what I need. Military planners are looking ahead to the next war. The French, we've already talked about, they have a not terribly poetically designated plan number 18, which is to invade Alsace Lorraine with élan. That's all you need, they said. Élan. Patriotic frenzy. Fury. All you need is to be on the offensive, and that's the end of it. By the way, they invade wearing red pants, and they could be shot, picked out through the fog, finally in 1914, until they put a little less bright colors on. Now, how are the Germans going to fight a war on two fronts? How are you going to do that? They're afraid of the Russians. Why? There's a lot of Russians and the other peoples. And they think it's going to take about 2 weeks for the Russian army, once mobilization is declared, that the big bear will roll their forces toward the German frontier in German Poland. So how are you going to win the war in 2 weeks? If you invade France, not through Alsace-Lorraine, but if you're going to have big trouble. You're going to run into fortifications. So how are you going to invade France? The only way you can defeat them, and a guy called Schlieffen, whose name I wrote in what I sent around to you, is that you have to invade Belgium. And from his point of view, the Netherlands. Though Moltke, his successor, takes the Netherlands out of the equation. Belgium had been declared independent and neutral in 1831. If you go into Belgium, the idea is you invade Belgium, you get through the big fort at Liège, get through the kind of rough country, which is not too much, and then you hit le plat pays, the flatlands, and you roll toward the English Channel. And the last thing Schlieffen importantly said on his deathbed was, the last soldier, his right arm should touch the English Channel. And then you turn down and you put Paris in a headlock, and they will sue for peace, and you will beat them in 2 weeks before the big bear can come moseying along slowly. That's why mobilization was tantamount to an act of war, because it starts the timetable, that they've got to defeat them in 2 weeks. What happens if you go through Belgium? From the point of view of the British, it's bad enough to have the sneaky French across the channel. But what if you got the Germans in Ostend eating moule frite? What if you have the Germans in Noche? What if you have the Germans across the channel too? Big time enemies, a very short, choppy boat ride away. So what this is going to do, it's going to reaffirm the alliance. And Sir Edward Grey, the one who said most famously, and he got it right, lights are going out in Europe. They will not be relit again in our lifetime. At this point, the British hesitate. The French said, will the word honor be struck from the English dictionary? The French ambassador is chasing around a high official in the Tsarist regime in Russia saying, you must back us all the way. And so the invasion guarantees that the worst nightmare of Bismarck will come true, that they will be à toi. And the fact that it doesn't work out for a variety of reasons, the way the German high command intended, and the way Schlieffen intended, and Moltke, means that they don't, for reasons I'll come back to, can't get Paris in that headlock, force them to sue for peace, and the race to the sea begins to try to outflank, as in a football game, if you'll take a ridiculous analogy, the outside linebacker, and they end up at the sea. And then shovels and defensive weapons like barbed wire and machine guns become the weapons of the war. And that explains why there wasn't, and subsequently could never be, a knockout punch, and why millions of people died in and around those trenches.